Before I begin, I just want to say how lovely the covenanting service was last week, and I just wanted to thank you, so many of you, for showing up in person and watching online. It meant a lot to me. And I also got a lot of messages about how adorable my sons were last week, holding on to one another, hugging each other. Now, if you were here in person last week, you know that it was particularly freezing in here last week, and even though I'd like to say that they were hugging because they love each other, which they mostly do, but they were really trying to conserve body heat. So it is a little bit more comfortable in here today, but still, snuggle up as we begin in prayer. God who breaks all boundaries, Christ whose ministry is love, Spirit who sends into mission, please be with me and with all of us as we open our hearts to this moment, as we open our hearts to you. Amen. As one of our wise ones in Bible study this week said, we should always be curious about why a book was included in the Bible, what its inclusion can teach us. The inclusion of the book of Ruth is remarkable in a number of ways. In what was undoubtedly a patriarchal society, it is a story centered on the female experience. Ruth and her mother-in-law, Naomi, aren't just there to advance the storyline of men. They are main actors. They are the ones that shape their own narratives and destinies. And in the case of Ruth, it is remarkable that not only is she a woman, but she is a Moabite woman. She is an outsider, an enemy even of the Israelite people. Throughout the Hebrew scriptures, there is a strong bias against anything good coming from Moab. For a Moabite to set foot in Judea would set off all the cultural, societal, religious warning bells of that time. Leaving Moab, Ruth would face not only a language barrier, a food barrier, a social etiquette barrier, and a religious practice barrier, she also would face the constant subtle and not so subtle reminders that she was not one of us. Ruth was a woman, an outsider, and she was a widower. There was, of course, no social safety net in the ancient world, and widows and orphans faced desperate circumstances. Compounding Ruth's plight, not only was she a widower, but she was a widower of a mixed marriage, and this was significant. While this story was set in the time of the Judges, sometime between 1300 and 1000 BCE, it was very likely written much later, after the exile to Babylon and the return to Jerusalem in the 5th century BCE. At this time, there was a movement, as demonstrated in the writings of Ezra and Nehemiah, to purify Israel and cement its ethnic identity by casting out foreign wives and their children from the land. If you know the Harry Potter books, this would have been like the Slytherin plot to rid Hogwarts of the so-called mudbloods. So Ruth, the main character of the book that carries her name, was a woman, an outsider, and a widower of a mixed marriage. She was a symbol of what was least valued in society. This is a story of someone constantly being pushed away. And yet, by the end of her story, and with the perspective of history, Ruth is someone who became central to the story of Israel. Through her came the line of David, and in time also came Jesus. So how did this happen? How did the ultimate outsider become central to the story of God's people? Let's take a closer look. In the first line that Rosalie read for us from the book of Ruth, we get a window into the context of the time. In the days of the judges, there was a famine in the land. In the days of the judges, there was a famine in the land. As it says in the book of Judges, this was a time when, quote, all the people did what was right in their own eyes. Without a unified vision or leadership, Israel was in trouble. But the more pressing problem at this moment was famine. The lack of food caused forced migrations, and so the underpinning of this story is dislocation. It is loss and suffering and hardship and hard choices about what to do next. The story begins in dislocation and, as we heard, in death. To escape famine in Bethlehem, Elimelech, his wife Naomi, and their two sons flee to Moab, in the land of Israel's bitter enemies. Death pursues them. Elimelech and the two sons die, leaving now three widows, Naomi and her two daughters-in-law, Orpah and Ruth. When Naomi learns that God has given food to the people of Judah, she begins her journey back home to Bethlehem, urging Orpah and Ruth to return to their families and homeland, where they may find new futures. The young women have a choice to make. The most logical one is to do as Naomi says and go back to Moab. And after many tears, this is the choice that Orpah makes. But for Ruth, the thought of life separate from her mother-in-law, who she loves, is too great. She clings to Naomi, clings. Clings is the word used to describe what Ruth does, clings. This is a powerful image that echoes Genesis 2:24. Therefore, a man leaves his father and his mother and clings to his wife, and they become one flesh. In the ancient world, tribal and family origins firmly fixed one's identity and one's gods. And the people did not readily abdicate either. But this is the choice that Ruth makes. She clings to Naomi, and a new identity, a new family is born. Then what comes next is some of the most beautiful and well-known poetry in our scriptures. Ruth tells Naomi, "Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There too will I be buried. Where you go, I will go." What was at the core of this relationship? It wasn't money, it wasn't status, and it certainly wasn't safety. It was, of course, love, and not some Hugh Grant, rom-com, Hallmark kind of love. This is the love forged by journeying through disruptive times together, journeying through despair and dislocation together. I hope you have had this kind of love and will have this kind of love in your life. People like Ruth in your life, the ones who show up in your most desperate times, the ones who don't leave when things get hard, the ones who say, "I will cling to you and you may cling to me. Whatever comes, we are going to get through this together." Whether in your family or friends or church community, I hope you have this kind of love in your life, because that is what is on display here with these remarkable women in this remarkable story. Where you go, I will go. Another thing that was noted in Bible study this week is that God does not appear to be a main character in this story. The action takes place among humans in everyday life, reacting to situations they are presented with, making choices, and living with the consequences of those choices. And while it is true that God doesn't get any lines in this story, God is entirely present as the backdrop to the whole story. God's role is implicit, and the people and their choices are recorded as to proclaim something important about the nature of God and how God's people are to relate to each other and their neighbors. Recall that this story was written in a time where some thought that the way to secure the future of the nation was to purge it from all foreign people and influences. And so what we can take from this seemingly simple story of Ruth is the acerbic counterclaim and theological affirmation of a God of all people. This God does not belong to one tribe alone, but seeks to gather all people into the same holy family. With God, what starts in dislocation and death turns to life renewed, and not just for the women, but for the whole people of Israel and beyond. Through the loyalty and devotion of the outsider, Ruth the Moabite, the line of David, God's anointed, is born. It is the one constantly being pushed to the margins that puts the fierce inclusivity of God on display. It is the one who clings to love that reveals the heart of God. It is the one who clings to love that puts the heart of God on full display. The circumstance in which the book of Ruth was written, the return from the Babylonian exile, was a pivotal time for the people. It was a time to work through big questions like, how has our past shaped us? Who are we now? And who do we want to be in the future? This is our anniversary Sunday. This is All Saints. This is a day when we are called to look at our past, celebrate the saints who have come before us, and see how their legacy shapes our present, and envision what our future could be. If you have been around Metropolitan Church for a while, you have likely heard the name Dr. Peter Bryce before. Actually, the Right Reverend Dr. Peter Bryce, to be accurate. I certainly remember Malcolm speaking of him and the long reach of his legacy in this place. Peter Bryce was the moderator of the United Church of Canada from 1936 to 1938, and was then called to this pulpit and served as the minister to this congregation until 1948. But before he was moderator and before he was minister here, Metropolitan called on Dr. Bryce to help shape the future of this church at a pivotal moment in its history, not once, but twice. The first time was after World War I, and Metropolitan was looking how it could best respond to the needs of the city at that disrupted time. Dr. Bryce noted that 11,000 fathers were killed in the war, leaving thousands of widows and orphans who were often forced to migrate to cities like Toronto to search for new lives. It was a Book of Ruth moment. He recommended Metropolitan set up an office to support these new immigrants to the city and to help welcome them into the fellowship of the church. Welcome these outsiders, these who seemingly had nothing to offer, into the family of the church. Dr. Bryce also recommended the hiring of a social worker to work with the ministers on complicated cases and to be a connection to other social agencies in the city. This was 1917, and was an important step in our long history of support for Toronto's most vulnerable, support that extends into today with our current community services team. Met is one of the only United Churches in the country with a team like this, specifically dedicated to on-the-ground support of our most vulnerable neighbors. A long reach indeed. The second time this church turned to Dr. Bryce was after the fire in 1928 that destroyed most of the building. This land in the downtown core was highly desirable even then, and the city of Toronto made it known that they coveted putting a new police administration building on this land. After the disruption of the fire, there were leading voices at that time that felt the congregation should, to use a modern term, cash in and amalgamate with another congregation. A committee was struck to evaluate the future of Metropolitan, and they once again turned to Dr. Bryce. He took his time and weighed all the options, but came to the conclusion that, quote, sacred tradition would appear to demand reconstruction of Metropolitan Church. He said that Metropolitan was a National Church Extraordinary, a National Church Extraordinary, and that it should continue to be a witness to the gospel and a place of preaching and music and mission in Toronto's downtown core. He also advocated for the building of a center that would be the heart of church activities and community services, a vision that manifested in different ways throughout our history, most recently as a space right below our feet that we know as the Met Center. Dr. Bryce was one of the saints of this church, who, like the scribe in our gospel reading, knew that the love of God was absolutely inseparable from the love of the neighbor, especially the vulnerable neighbor, the Naomis of this world, the Ruths of this world. To those of you who joined this church today, if you want to know what this place is all about, it's all right there in Mark 12. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength, and you shall love the neighbor as yourself. It's all right there. As has happened in other times in our history, this moment of emerging from the disruption and dislocation of a global pandemic is again the time to work through big questions like, how has our past shaped us? Who are we now? What do we want our future to be? It is time to ask ourselves, what would it look like in our days to be a National Church Extraordinary? This is a time of disruption and dislocation, and it is exactly the time to ask these questions and to lean on the wisdom of the saints, those wise ones in our past and amongst us now, the ones who call us towards community and service and discipleship, the ones who call us to show up for each other, to cling to one another, to, especially when things get hard, the ones who say that whatever comes, we are going to get through this together. The ones then and now who cling to love and reveal the heart of God. The ones who cling to love and reveal the heart of God. What is the greatest commandment? Love God. Love your neighbor as yourself. This is the vision we cling to. This is the hope we have to share. May it be so.